Hello, and welcome to Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. I'm Gina Briner, Editor-in-Chief at Live Science.
And I'm Mindy Weisberger, a Senior Writer at Live Science.
Today, we're bringing you a special episode of Life's Little Mysteries. Usually, we keep things pretty light, but this time, we're going to focus on a serious topic that everybody is talking about, and that's the SARS coronavirus 2, the virus that causes the disease COVID-19.
At Life Science, our reporters and our editors are tracking the latest coronavirus developments around the world, from global case numbers and quarantines to vaccine development to best practices for safety, prevention, and treatment.
Here with the latest coronavirus news is Life Science health reporter Nicoletta Lanice. She's at the forefront of our coronavirus coverage.
This episode was recorded on April 23rd and features Nicoletta's weekly coronavirus update and Q&A. New updates are live streamed on Facebook every Thursday at 12 p.m. ET.
Hi, and welcome to this week's coronavirus update from Live Science. My name is Nicoletta Lanice, and I'm a health reporter here at the site, and I'm here to answer your questions about COVID-19 and the ongoing pandemic. I usually start off this live stream with a brief recap of the worldwide case counts and get into some of the updates that we've covered on the site itself this week. So if you have any questions throughout, please stick them in the comments below, and we'll try to get to as many as possible. But if I don't get to one of your questions, know that many of these, if not all of them, are addressed on the Live Science website, where we have provided many written articles getting into the nitty-gritty of what's going on here. So just to get started, our total case count worldwide right now rests above 2.6 million cases. Again, to give you context for the case counts, confirmed cases means that people have been formally diagnosed with COVID-19. There are many people who have gone untested. There are many people who might have had the disease and recovered. We don't know what the scope of those numbers are. But as far as confirmed cases go, we're now above 2.6 million. Worldwide, we've seen that the death count now exceeds 185,000 worldwide. Just to give you an idea of what's happening in China, where the outbreak began, they are now reporting 83,900 cases as of this week. Last week, that count was 83,400 cases. So you can see how steeply the number of new cases has dropped off as the weeks progress. Here in the US, we're seeing that we're up to nearly 844,000 confirmed cases, and that is up from 640,000 as of last week. So the number continues to ascend as diagnostic capacity expands, but also the outbreak will just continue to hop to new places and spread in new communities as we go. Here in the US, the death toll is nearly up to 46,800 nationwide, and that number continues to go up as the number of hospitalizations goes up. And some people who are dying of COVID-19 might not be dying within the hospital system and may be going unnoticed as well. So even the death count might be slightly inflated. You might hear a cat wander through the background of this live stream occasionally. He's being a bit more vocal this week. That's Pete for anyone who's asking. So coming into some of our updates from the site this week, I'll focus on New York State for a moment. A few studies have specifically focused on this area. A study that came out in the journal JAMA found that 88% of people who have required mechanical ventilation, meaning that they needed an invasive form of breathing support, ventilators force air into the lungs via a pressurized system. So 88% of people who required mechanical ventilation still ended up dying from COVID-19. And these were a group of 320 people placed on ventilators out of 5,700 included in the study. So to give you some context for what that really means, people with very severe cases of COVID-19 see a massive drop off in blood oxygen levels often, meaning that there is less oxygen available to circulate through the bloodstream. This is for a variety of reasons, namely because the lungs are so compromised and damaged by the viral infection that they, in a pneumonia, may fill with pus, which prevents oxygen from being transferred from the lungs into the bloodstream. But there's many other reasons as to why the blood oxygen levels are dropping off. So what we're seeing is that it may be that a subset of patients who have these really low blood oxygen levels, which could lead to organ damage or eventually death, they might not all benefit from the use of a ventilator. And there's been some coverage of this in the past. Stat News did a really great report that we summed up in one of our reports, showing that patients who show low blood oxygen levels but have few outward signs of distress. So some people are presenting with super duper low blood oxygen levels that should at face value cause them to start hyperventilating, showing signs that they're really struggling to breathe. But what's happening is they're not showing these overt signs right away. So there's a big question of why that is. And there's lots of theories floating around. But it may be that these patients are because there's not a direct correlation between the low blood oxygen levels and the function of the lungs or apparent damage in the lungs. It may be that the ventilation isn't the best route of action for them. And we need to learn more about what the best course of treatment would be. And even if people come to develop a thick fluid in their lungs, this is called acute respiratory distress syndrome. And this thick fluid, mucus-like fluid builds up and it, again, makes it difficult for oxygen to pass from the lungs into the bloodstream. Even if that's taking place, it may be that ventilation doesn't help those people either, because ventilation, again, forces oxygen into the lungs via a pressurized system, basically doing the work of breathing for you. And if that pressure is being placed on a wall of sticky, thick fluid, it's not necessarily helping more oxygen get into the bloodstream in the first place. But it's also placing pressure on the organ itself and on all the delicate structures that pass oxygen from the outer world through the lungs and into the bloodstream. So the take-home message from this is that doctors across the nation for weeks have been saying that we need to be more nuanced about who we put on ventilation because it doesn't seem to help all COVID-19 patients who at face value might require it. We need to come up with new ways of assessing who needs a ventilator and who doesn't need a ventilator. Another report that we covered this week was on, we're seeing that the first death in the U.S. attributed to COVID-19. Originally, we thought the first death from COVID-19 in the U.S. took place on February 26th, I believe, two COVID-19 related deaths in a suburb of Seattle. But now, upon further investigation, a medical coroner has found that the first deaths that we know about that occurred in the U.S. actually took place on February 6th and February 17th in Santa Clara County in California. And this was determined through tissue samples from both these cases being tested for the virus and coming back positive. So that would imply that the virus was circulating, at least in California, earlier than originally noted. Given that these deaths took place in early February, that would imply if these people had a fairly normal course of illness, that they might have contracted the virus perhaps in early to mid-January. So that's still within the margin of error that we suspected, but this shifts the date a little bit once more. And this has also been backed by a preliminary antibody study that was run out of Stanford University. You might have heard about this study that suggests that between 50 and 85 times as many people in Santa Clara County show antibodies for the coronavirus, but hadn't previously tested for it, meaning that they hadn't received a diagnostic test at all. There's a lot of caveats to this early antibody study. Number one, the recruitment process was through Facebook ads. So that's a very specific audience you're targeting. And it was heavily skewed towards women and fairly affluent people who participated in the study and only included about 3,300 participants, which out of the whole scope of Santa Clara County is not fully representative. And again, the diversity was very skewed towards women and more affluent people in the community. And the actual test that they use to test for antibodies, for background, antibodies are a sign that the immune system has mounted a specific response against a new pathogen. These antibodies can latch onto a specific part, a specific protein or part of a protein that's on the pathogen and help the immune system target that germ. So the specificity of the tests that look for those antibodies, the ones used in this study, have been now seen as tenuous. So the tests originally came from China, and China has now stopped those specific tests from being imported because they're seen to be not fully accurate. So a lot of caveats to that study, but generally the more antibody studies that we're seeing and the shifting date of the earliest death implies that the virus was circulating in the U.S. sooner than we originally tagged. And that's an assumption that people had for quite some time, and now the data is backing that up a bit more. But again, barring more antibody studies, that will give us a clearer picture of maybe that the extent of spread within communities that hasn't been noted yet. On the vaccine front, there's a new coronavirus vaccine being trialed in the UK as of this week. This vaccine combines a weakened version of a common cold virus, not a coronavirus, but an adenovirus. And it combines this common cold virus with genes coding for the spike protein on the novel coronavirus. So the spike protein is the protein that the virus uses to plug into cells and infect them. It's thought that this is a great protein to target in a vaccine because it's so critical for the virus's function. It needs this protein to replicate as it does normally when it infects cells. So if you target that critical protein, it's unlikely that that protein will change much as the virus continues to mutate slowly through time. So that's why it's thought to be a good target for a vaccine in the first place. So this new vaccine cannot infect people with the common cold virus that they're using as the base. The common cold virus is deactivated, if you will. And it will be given to 510 healthy volunteers between the ages of 18 and 55. And about half these volunteers will be given the vaccine and the other half will serve as a control group and will receive a different vaccine, which protects against meningitis and sepsis, which are different types of infections. There's also a at-home clinical trial, not of a vaccine, but of a possible preventative treatment for severe symptoms of COVID-19. So this at-home clinical trial, so-called, will include about 6,000 participants in the U.S., Canada, and Europe. And these participants will have tested positive for the virus, but don't require hospitalization. So they'll be sent home to quarantine. And within 48 hours of receiving this diagnosis, if they're enrolled in the study, they will receive the anti-inflammatory drug. Excuse me if I mispronounce its name. It's colchicine, I believe it's pronounced. But anyway, this is a widely used anti-inflammatory drug used to treat gout, which is a type of arthritis that causes pain and swelling in the joints. And it's thought that the thinking behind this study is that some COVID-19 patients, once they hit a dangerous, really severe phase of the infection, you see evidence of cytokine storms. Cytokine storms occur when the inflammatory substances that the body rallies in order to help fight off an infection, they end up running out of control and actually damaging tissues in the body rather than clearing that pathogen out as it's intended to do. So cytokine storms are seen as a complication of COVID-19 in severe cases. So this at-home clinical trial is aiming to see if there's some correlation between using anti-inflammatory medications like this one early in the course of illness to see if maybe that prevents patients from progressing to this cytokine storm point of the illness. The participants enrolled in this particular trial must be age 40 and older and have at least one major risk factor that might place them in a high-risk category for severe COVID-19 infection. So that might include hypertension, diabetes, some sort of immunocompromising condition. And if you yourself are interested in learning more about the study or learning how you can participate, because they are recruiting many participants, you can find that information on the article on Live Science if you search at-home clinical trial of COVID-19, for COVID-19. I'm going to give you one more quick update from our coverage this week, and then I'm going to lapse into your questions. The last study I want to touch on was one that looked into genetic variations that might leave people vulnerable to serious COVID-19 infection. So in general, there are many studies of genetics going on to try to pinpoint what specific genes and variations within those genes might leave some people susceptible to developing pneumonia, developing organ damage from COVID-19. It's thought that the genes that instruct cells to build the ACE2 receptor, which the virus uses to infect cells, it's thought that these genes might differ between people with severe illness and people with mild illness that show little symptoms or few symptoms. There's another thought that differences might lie in genes that help to rally the immune system against new pathogens. So it's either perhaps within differences within the ACE2 receptor or within the immune system itself at large. So one new study that we covered looked, this is fairly preliminary, but looked at HLA genes, which help to train the immune system to recognize new pathogens. So what HLA genes do is they come in many varieties, and they code for proteins that are able to kind of grab up tiny bits of a virus or a bacterium or any other pathogen, these bits being peptides, so very short sequences within larger proteins. And they present these peptides to immune cells, which look at that, figuratively look at that peptide, and then go on to train the immune system to build antibodies that latch onto that peptide specifically. So that's glossing over a lot of intricate details. This is one piece in the larger machine of our immune system. But it's thought that certain HLA genes will help the body to recognize the virus that causes COVID-19, while others might not be very good at recognizing bits of that pathogen. And this varies between populations of people. It varies dramatically between individuals. We covered a recent study that specifically talks about the HLA-B4601 HLA, which is a specific HLA type, and suggests this might be very bad at recognizing the SARS-CoV-2 virus. But this was a study done completely in computer models. So now they're moving to follow up that type of study with actual COVID-19 patients to see if differences in their HLA types actually makes a difference to their immune responses to the virus. So barring clinical data to correlate with this genetic data, a lot of these genetic studies won't hold much value in clinic. So we're in the early days of this research, but once moving ahead, everyone's planning on kind of bringing those two worlds together to make sure the what we're seeing in genetics and theorizing about with the genetics matches what we're actually seeing in patients. And with that, start looking at a few of your questions. I'm getting a question about just the major symptoms, the common symptoms of COVID-19. So as the weeks have gone on, this list has grown longer and longer. And I apologize for all the caveats I'll have to throw in throughout this list. But the most common symptoms tend to be fever. For a mild infection, you might see a mild fever. More severe infection, higher fever. People develop a dry cough. There have been now confirmed reports of people with a loss of smell and taste early on in the course of illness. And often, at least from what we see in the data so far, these people seem to typically have milder infections and tend to recover both their sense of smell, but recover from the virus with fairly low numbers of symptoms. But that's not a universal finding. So fever, coughing, smell and taste lost. Some people only present with digestive symptoms, meaning perhaps diarrhea or nausea, different things like that. So there are ACE2 receptors. Again, ACE2 receptors are what the virus uses to infect cells. ACE2 receptors appear not only in the respiratory tracts and the lungs, but in structures throughout the body, including a high volume in the gastrointestinal system. So it's thought preliminarily that it's possible that this virus might also target the GI tract, which might be why some people mostly show digestive issues. In rare cases, you're seeing people report altered mental state. So some of this is connected to the cytokine storms I mentioned earlier. In very rare cases, and this goes for several viral illnesses, if the body launches too strong an immune response to a viral infection, it can ignite that cytokine storm, which can damage organs throughout the body. But if that cytokine storm is occurring in the brain, that can actually cause damage to tissues in the brain and result in an altered mental state. So confusion, lack of focus, disorientation, things like that. And there have been scattered reports of this occurring with COVID-19. It's not unique to COVID-19 again. You can see this happen with other viral infections, but that's fairly rare. But you might also see an altered mental state if your blood oxygen levels drop very low and the carbon dioxide builds up in your body as your lung function diminishes. So that is also connected to confusion, altered mental state occasionally. So I think I hit all the major symptoms there. Again, this virus presents differently in many individuals. So because it's such a wide array of symptoms, it's sometimes difficult at face value to say that's for sure COVID-19 as compared to another viral infection, because a lot of these symptoms overlap with other diseases. Someone's asking if there's new information as to why so many people show no or minimal symptoms to the virus, being that many of the actions taken are precautionary against these mildly infected people spreading the virus. So there's theories as to why some people show minimal symptoms. Part of this might be, again, this is very anecdotal and theoretical, but because there are four common coronaviruses that circulate seasonally, so these common viruses cause the common cold, and they share structural similarities to this new coronavirus, there is some talk of potential cross-immunity, limited cross-immunity between these common coronaviruses and the novel one. So if you've been exposed to one of these common coronaviruses, there's a chance that perhaps your immune system recognizes the new SARS-CoV-2 virus vaguely. It might recognize bits of that virus and start your immune response earlier while the viral load in your body is lower. So if that immune response goes up earlier, there's a chance that you would clear the virus from your body more efficiently. There's also, that goes back to genetics as well, where perhaps some people's genetics, just by virtue of their genetic code, happen to have some resilience against the virus at baseline. So they clear it from their systems more efficiently than people without these genes or with different versions of these genes. So that's another theory. It may be that, again, because this virus emerged in the midst of our normal flu season, it might be that some people just thought they had a mild case of the flu. I guess what I'm trying to say is that people might have mistaken symptoms of this illness for a different one, so still spread it throughout the community even though they were showing minimal symptoms, because that is culturally a thing that happens. People move about their communities even though they're sick and probably spreading illnesses to others, which is why we're taking precautions and socially distancing and wearing masks and all these things. So don't think of it like the flu, but think of it like if you contract any mild viral infection, what is your personal likelihood of staying home all the time in a non-pandemic situation and moving through your community? And that chance is probably high if you're not feeling too, too bad. My summary for this long-winded explanation is that the immune system is complicated and shows dramatic variation between individuals. So there's lots of factors that play into whether you contract a severe infection or a mild infection. And because we don't have all those reasons parsed out, and people with any viral infection cannot recognize early on that they themselves are infected. That's not a thing that we can inherently do. We can't inherently diagnose ourselves when we're sick. That's why we're taking so many precautions, because there is such a large portion of the population that is at risk of requiring hospitalization and extensive care because of this virus. Someone's asking if there was any chance we saw signs, I'm assuming in the US is the framing of this question, Any chance that we saw signs of COVID-19 spreading back in 2019 beyond China? So the earliest date that they've been able to pinpoint for the earliest known infection within China was back in November. Given the amount of travel in and out of China all the time, and especially international travel in this scenario, there's a chance that that COVID-19 began spreading outside of China in 2019. We don't know when it appeared in different places exactly. We would have to do continued detective work, may reveal when the first cases emerged in other countries. And of course, different countries had different instances that infection occurred. But yes, there is a chance that it was spreading beyond China in 2019, given the heavy international traffic in and out of China. Someone's asking how many days it typically takes for the first symptoms to appear. So most people, from what the data suggests, begin developing symptoms within the first week of contracting the virus. So within about 1 to 5 days more specifically. But again, with the large variation between people, that's not always a tried and true number. That's an average, I'm telling you. But generally speaking, within the first week of contracting the virus, you would see symptoms. Some people don't see it until perhaps the second week, though. And again, some people develop such mild infections, they might not even realize that they're infected. I'm getting a number of questions about whether different, quote unquote, different strains of the virus are circulating. So all the data that we have at this point indicate that the virus is mutating fairly slowly. For context, all viruses mutate. This is part of just their natural evolution as they replicate, and they replicate quickly in hosts. With each replication, there's a chance that mutation can occur, and those mutations, if they allow the virus to replicate more efficiently or offer some other benefit to the virus that enables it to function better, survive better, it's likely that those mutations will persist through time, etc. Different viruses mutate at different rates. COVID-19, or SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19, like other coronaviruses, appears to mutate very slowly. So even those four common cold coronaviruses that I mentioned before, year to year, they really don't change dramatically. And we've known about these for a long time. So COVID-19 at this point appears to fall in line with those as well. And similar results were found in studies of the viruses that cause SARS and MERS, which also came from animals and were passed to humans, just like the SARS-CoV virus. So while there is variation within the COVID-2 viruses that are circulating currently, they are not so different from each other that we would consider them wholly distinct strains. Rather, these subtle, fairly subtle differences allow us to track the evolution and the trajectory of the virus through time. So this is how people figure out, for instance, that New York seemed to, early on in their outbreak, accrue a lot of cases from Europeans, because they were able to trace those subtle changes in the virus's genetic code and see that most of that evolution took place from within travelers from Europe. Now, within California, they were able to trace it back to mostly cases from Asia. So this is what, at this point, it seems like the mutations within the coronavirus are helpful for tracking. And of course, in developing treatments and developing vaccines, scientists will continue to track how quickly the virus is mutating. But all data points to the idea that it's not mutating that quickly at this time. And historically, coronaviruses don't seem to mutate that quickly. I'm getting a question about hydroxychloroquine. Note that hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine are related drugs and they are used for similar things. I'll give you what data we have on hydroxychloroquine at this point. So it was thrown out that hydroxychloroquine and its related drug chloroquine, which are FDA approved for other uses, might confer some benefit to COVID-19 patients if prescribed off-label. Note that as of weeks ago, more than 80 drugs that already exist were being tested for similar overlapping efficacy with COVID-19. So this is not a unique thing that's happening. A lot of antivirals are being tested on this front, as well as anti-inflammatory drugs, like I mentioned. So this is just a worldwide effort that's happening. That said, hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine, while for their intended purposes or their approved purposes, are prescribed at fairly low doses and are well tolerated by patients, meaning they don't have serious side effects most of the time. Although you might see some develop if you take those drugs for a prolonged period of time. For instance, you see damage to, you might have some vision loss as a result of taking these drugs. If you take these drugs at high doses, there's a high risk of heart problems, arrhythmias, and overdosing on these drugs can be fatal. This is a well-known risk of taking these drugs, especially at high doses. Again, when they're prescribed for lupus or rheumatoid arthritis, these other approved purposes, they are given at a tolerable dose. That said, the early studies looking at using these drugs for COVID-19, number one, are in their very early days. And number two, a number of them have been stopped early because patients developed these heart problems or died while taking the drugs. At this point, the FDA is not recommending. They're recommending against the use of these drugs outside of the context of a clinical trial. So if you, for some reason, have these drugs in your cabinet, the FDA is recommending against the use of those drugs as a COVID-19 treatment, as a COVID-19 preventative, outside of the context of a clinical trial where you're being monitored by doctors closely, you're having your vitals taken all the time, and they are prepared to adjust your dosing if you show poor symptoms. So that all being a long-winded way to say there are many treatments and trials. Hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine, of all the treatments and trials, do not appear to be the most promising option at this point, partially because taken at high doses, they present these very serious risks. If you want to learn about other treatments that are in trials, we have an article breaking down a number of both promising and overturned options in an article on Live Science. If you just search treatments for COVID-19, Live Science. I'm going to answer two more questions because we're coming to the end of our time. Getting a question about cats being vulnerable to catching COVID-19. So both formal studies and anecdotal accounts has communicated to us that cats can catch COVID-19. In the instances that have been tracked anecdotally, these cats have caught it from infected humans sharing their living space. So cat owners have caught COVID-19 and passed it on to their pets. That said, there's no sign that cats can pass the virus to humans. And this, there's various reasons for this, but it's likely that once the virus passes into felines, it undergoes mutations that make it so that it's not as effective at infecting humans anymore. More studies are being done as to why that is, but this was also seen with the related SARS-CoV virus. So this causes severe acute respiratory syndrome, which was seen in an outbreak in 2002 and 2003. At that time, there were also accounts of cats catching the virus, but there was no evidence accrued at that time either that cats could pass the virus back to humans. That said, it does seem like cats can pass it to each other through respiratory droplets especially, which is also how one way that the virus passes between people. So if you have multiple cats, perhaps that is something to consider. But at this point, it doesn't seem like cats can pass it to humans. I'm getting a question about immunity to the virus. The issue of how long one remains immune to the virus and if one is immune to the virus after catching it is a big one and one that we don't have particularly satisfying answers to yet. So in general, in people who contract COVID, what we've seen is that many people generate neutralizing antibodies that are specific to the virus. The presence of these neutralizing antibodies is thought to protect the person against catching the infection a second time. the question becomes, is the antibody response alone, evidence of an antibody response alone, indicative of that immunity lasting a long time, of that immunity being really strong, and whether we can get that same kind of immunity from a vaccine. So vaccines work in a similar way to a natural virus. It's kind of trying to mimic a natural virus to trigger immunity in the body without making the person sick, is the idea behind vaccines. So all these questions are very important to vaccine development. There is a possibility, because we see these seasonal coronaviruses come back every year, they change very little, and yet people can still get infected with them over and over. And there's a huge question as to why we see that with the seasonal coronaviruses. So we are thinking that there might be some drop-off in immunity among those common coronaviruses, and we're wondering whether this could also be a problem for this new coronavirus. Because they're not changing their form dramatically through time, it's thought that there might be a change occurring at the level of the immune system itself in its ability to recognize the virus, even though it's coming back in a familiar form. So that's a huge question, and unfortunately one we won't be able to answer until we see how immunity lasts through time. So again, this virus emerged last year. So no one's been infected and recovered for a long enough time for us to really understand long-term immunity at this point. That said, there have been early studies in animals that suggest that the antibody response does at least protect an animal from catching the infection twice in the short term. For instance, there was a study of rhesus macaques, which are a type of monkey. So they have a very similar immune system to us, and they also contract similar symptoms to the virus when infected. So there is evidence that there is some immunity upon first exposure. The big question is, how long does that immunity last? And also, is that immunity dose dependent? What do I mean by that? Dose dependent on how much virus you're exposed to in the first place. So we see this relationship with other viruses, for instance, influenza viruses. If you're exposed to a very teeny tiny dose of influenza, an influenza virus, your body might mount a non-specific immune response against the virus in order to clear it from the body. But you might not actually be prompted to generate specific antibodies if the dose is too low. However, above a certain threshold, you see that specific antibodies are generated, and then that person would be protected more specifically against that influenza virus. There's a question as to whether the initial exposure to the SARS-CoV virus, if it's a small one, would prompt a person to be immune to a second exposure, and also whether the dose matters in terms of how long you remain immune. So these are all huge questions, and it all comes back to the general theme of the immune system being very complicated. Such variation exists within individuals' immune systems that it will take us a while to find satisfying answers to these questions. Thankfully, because the virus does not mutate quickly, progress towards a vaccine still seems promising, because even if it only confers immunity for 1 to 2 years, which is what has been estimated for the related SARS-CoV virus in terms of naturally gained immunity from infection, that would still provide us time to perhaps look into a longer lasting vaccine. So I'll leave you on that hopefully hopeful note. And again, if I didn't get to any of your questions today, many of these, if not all of them, are addressed on livescience.com. And you can always pose more questions on our forums, forums.livescience.com.
Thanks for joining us for this special coronavirus report from Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. You can find all the Live Science coverage of the coronavirus and COVID-19 on our website at livescience.com/topics/coronavirus.
We'll be refreshing our FAQ and coronavirus updates daily as information becomes available. The link is in the show notes.
If you have questions about coronavirus or COVID-19, you can post them on our Live Science forums and on Facebook.
Thanks for joining us, and stay healthy.
Life's Little Mysteries is produced in conjunction with Audio Boom as part of their Audio Boom Originals Network.